I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday afternoon. Mondays at 1, always all things political, and my goodness, do we have a lot to talk about today. We could just really center on Friday of last week, which I think that's where we'll start. Molly Ball is our guest. She's a staff writer covering U.S. politics at The Atlantic. On Friday, of course, we saw the historic Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage. The day before, the ruling on the Affordable Care Act. On Friday, we also saw the president give a very moving eulogy for Reverend Clemente Pinckney in Charleston, South Carolina. We saw support for the Confederate flag come tumbling down. The Supreme Court has made other decisions today, and so there is a lot on the table. It's interesting. Some people saw Friday is a very moving day, certainly a celebration for many people of the victory of marriage equality, but also the day of mourning for Reverend Clemente Pinckney when President Obama delivered a much heralded address that looked at issues of race and the Civil War and grace. He talked a lot about grace, a word that I hadn't thought a whole lot about, but after that eulogy, I thought a lot more about race. Other people saw last week is not a very good week. Senator Ted Cruz said that last week had featured some of the darkest 24 hours in our history. The Republicans who are running for president had very different interpretations of the Supreme Court rulings on both days. And we will talk about that and how these issues may play in the presidential election, because we've got a presidential election coming up. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Molly. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. And just a reminder, hour two of our program today, we will be talking about the same-sex marriage ruling. So that will be a full hour. We'll touch on it this hour of our show, but a full hour discussion coming up, hour number two. All right. All right. Hello, Molly. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you with us. Let's just start with last Friday, which was an extraordinary day in our history, I thought, with the Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage and then the president traveling to the heart of the Confederacy, the once Confederacy, to give that very stirring eulogy. It really was a time of mourning, and for many, a time of celebration. It was a huge day in our country.
It was a really emotional day, and I think what a lot of people felt, especially a lot of progressives and liberals, was that you could feel a sort of breakthrough in these divisive culture wars that we've been having, that even though obviously in both of those events that you cited, there's evidence of how divided we are, there's also a sense that the Obama era that so many people, especially a lot of his supporters, persistently felt was not happening, right? That the hope and change that Obama promised had been stymied on so many fronts, that there was finally a sense of it dawning, that there was finally a sense that we had moved into a new age, that when, you know, the historians look back and start to assess Obama's legacy, that this is something that they'll point to as evidence that the nation sort of moved into a new age during his presidency.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking of the emotions that he was going through in a two-hour period of time when he was, we saw those pictures of him with his hands up hearing the Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act, and then he had to go to Charleston shortly thereafter to give and the same kind of response for the same-sex marriage, and then to go to Charleston to have to give this eulogy. I mean, talk about taking in and having to be a consoler and somebody who's interpreting all of these massive events. What a time he must have been going through.
Absolutely. Although I think what you saw with the eulogy and the reason so many people found it so moving and inspiring was that the president really seized it as a moment to offer a message of hope and moving forward, and to invoke Reverend Pinckney's legacy to say, here are some, here's what he would want us to do. He would want us to use this to build momentum and to move forward and to look at what's happening with the Confederate flag and with the way that that community seems to actually be coming together and healing in some ways on the heels of this incredibly horrific hate crime, is to see the possibilities for how an incident like that doesn't have to only be an occasion for terrible sadness.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend some time talking about the flag and how it's, the calls are coming from all quarters now. It's time for the Confederate flag to go. This is what the president said during that eulogy about the flag. And then we'll talk about how in a period of a few days, perhaps because of the horrors that happened there, everybody seemed to agree it's time for the flag to come down. Here's the president in Charleston at the funeral for Reverend Clemente Pinckney.
For too long, we were blind to the pain that the Confederate flag stirred in too many of our citizens. It's true, a flag did not cause these murders. But as people from all walks of life, Republicans and Democrats, yes, now acknowledge, including Governor Haley, whose recent eloquence on the subject is worthy of praise. As we all have to acknowledge, the flag has always represented more than just ancestral pride. By taking down that flag, we express God's grace.
It was the horror of what happened. One commentator said, Molly, that maybe Christianity played a potent role, not only in the response to this horrific shooting, but in response to the flag going down as well. Well, people were perhaps feeling guilt. They were incredibly moved by the response to this shooting.
Yeah, and you saw some Christian leaders, thinking particularly of Russell Moore, the leader of the Southern Baptists, calling for the flag to be taken down in very moving terms, saying that it was a matter of Christian fellowship, that these people, you know, who were gunned down in their church at a time when they had gathered in the act of prayer, that Christians should come together in brotherhood with their African American brothers and sisters and call for the flag to be taken down. You know, you heard the president invoking Nikki Haley, the Republican governor of South Carolina, and I really think that this issue would not have gotten anywhere without her leadership on it. And Republican politicians, a lot of them, have felt for a long time that it was embarrassing, that it was an obstacle to the big business, the international business that is increasingly located in the American South, to have that flag still flying. But nobody was willing to step out on it until Governor Haley was, sort of led the charge, brought everyone together, Republicans and Democrats, but a lot of Republicans who are the majority of office holders in South Carolina, to say, all right, it's time to end this.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the Affordable Care Act, that decision, 6-3 decision, which surprised me that it was that strong. Does this put in place the Affordable Care Act now forever, or will it stop all of the, what have there been, 50 or 60 some legislative attempts to repeal the legislation? Is that over now or not?
It's definitely not over. And it's still going to be an issue in the 2016 campaign. Republicans are still opposed to it. But with every passing day, it gets harder and harder for them to repeal it, partly because, you know, had the Supreme Court ruled the other way, a lot of Republicans were very anxious about what they would say to these about 6 million Americans who would have lost their health care subsidies. Republicans, firmly and in good faith, believe that this is a bad law, but they haven't done a very good job of coming up with a real solution to replace it and to help the people who are now being helped by Obamacare. So I do think that, and the administration has always felt that, the more this law became entrenched as a part of the American system, the harder it would be for opponents to do away with it. I mean, look, there are still people who believe that the New Deal was a bad idea and are trying to repeal Social Security and those parts of the welfare state. But it's very, very, very difficult, if not impossible, to do that because so many Americans depend on them and have accepted them as sort of a natural part of our national fabric. And that is what the administration thinks is eventually going to happen with Obamacare as well.
Mm-hmm. And though we're going to spend a full hour on it, the second hour of our program today, the same-sex marriage was a very, very historic ruling. All the Republican presidential candidates expressed their extreme displeasure, some calling for a constitutional amendment. I wonder what is the possibility of that happening, and does this particular issue go away and will not be a part of the presidential campaign because it has been decided by the Supreme Court, or is it a rallying cry for Republican conservatives?
It's both, and I think that to the extent that there are going to be candidates using it as a wedge in the Republican primary, you will still hear about it. I think you'll hear very little about it in the general election. We saw that last time in 2012 when President Obama came out in favor of gay marriage in the heat of the 2012 election, and there was almost no debate on it, even though Mitt Romney was sort of nominally opposed to same-sex marriage. It was definitely not used by his side as a wedge, and even the Democrats actually used it as a wedge against Romney to get younger voters particularly on their side. And I think that both sides know that that's sort of the state of play now, is that this is an issue that has majority support. Most polls, most national polls show that 60% or more of Americans before the Supreme Court ruling were in favor of gay marriage. It had already come to 36 states, including some of the reddest states in America, states like Utah, and there had been very little backlash against it. In fact, when there were attempts to enact these religious freedom laws, like in Indiana, the backlash tended to be against those, not against the new phenomenon of gay people getting married in these states. So I think that a lot of Republicans would like to declare a truce on this issue publicly or privately and not have it used against them because it's not an issue that favors them as it used to be.
So what did they move on to?
In terms of what do they campaign on? I mean,
yes,
it's going to depend on who's the Republican nominee. Well, there's obviously a lot of issues on which Republicans and Democrats disagree. But I mean, I think on social issues, depending on who the Republicans nominate, they face a choice between real culture warriors like Mike Huckabee, who seem to actually be advocating civil disobedience in the face of the Supreme Court ruling, people like Bobby Jindal, who have run very hard on the issue of religious freedom, but who are still saying that we have to accept the Supreme Court's ruling, people like Scott Walker, who are talking about a constitutional amendment. That's something that realistically is probably not going to happen. And I think you all in Wisconsin saw from the way Scott Walker messaged his reelection campaign that this is someone who feels he can emphasize different parts of his political persona at different times, appearing to be more of an economics-based candidate for the general electorate, even as he tries to appeal to a socially conservative electorate, perhaps in the primary. And you have other, you know, a lot of other Republicans in the field, people like Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, saying, we disagree with this decision, but this is how it is now.
Jonathan Martin had an interesting piece today or yesterday or sometime in the last couple of days looking at all of these decisions, and let me quote and get your response to what he said. Some of the strategists advising Republican hopefuls believe the last week has been nothing short of a gift from above, a great unburdening on issues of race and sexuality and on health care, a disaster for the Republicans averted.
Yeah, absolutely. The Republicans, a lot of Republicans in sort of the consultant class, the Republican establishment, who are looking forward to the 2016 general election and the prospect of going up against most likely Hillary Clinton, do feel that the Republican Party is better served to move past these debates that make them look like they're sort of fighting past battles and the party of yesteryear, right? The party of sort of old, angry white people who want to go back to a past that is behind us. So it will depend on who the nominee is. It will depend on how things shape up in 2016. But there are a lot of Republicans who feel like this frees them up and gives them space to talk about the issues that they think are a better sell with the American public as a whole, the economic issues, the issues of national security, the things where they're on a little bit further footing in the types of things they're proposing.
Molly Ball is our guest for All Things Political this hour, this Monday, and we're going to be welcoming your phone calls of all of the big news that happened last week and we had two more Supreme Court decisions today, at least two that I'm aware of. The Supreme Court threw out an Environmental Protection Agency regulation limiting mercury and other toxic emissions from power plants. The case looked at the EPA's regulation of mercury from power plants under the Clean Air Act and interpreted the law unreasonably when it failed to consider the costs of compliance with the new regulations. There was also an Arizona redistricting commission. It upheld the right of a commission to do redistricting, not just in the purview of the legislature. So that happened today as well. And I'm just interested in all of your responses to the major shifts that have taken place. The same-sex marriage decision by the Supreme Court, the handing the Affordable Care Act more legitimacy, what you think of that. What do you think of the president's comments in Charleston, South Carolina last week? If you didn't see the eulogy, I would recommend that you do, because it was historic just to see this president in this particular place filled with so much history of trying to combat racism, be at the forefront of civil rights, church that had been burned to the ground and where slaves congregated. It's so rich in moving ahead history and real tragedy that his being there in a church with a mostly African-American audience, people who had been so filled with grace, as he would put it, in their response to all of this, was very moving. So let's welcome your phone calls. What did you make of all of this? 800-486-8655. Would you agree that the Affordable Care Act for the first time looks safe after being upheld by the Supreme Court twice now? And we'll talk at great length, hour two, about the same-sex marriage case and how that happened right now. But please feel free to join our conversation. And, of course, all of this has to be looked at with a political lens because of the election coming up. Do the Republicans see this as a lifting of a burden that they don't really have to campaign fully now on the Affordable Care Act because it looks like it's here to stay? They don't really have to rail against same-sex marriage because it is the law of the land now. So does it allow them to move to areas where they will be saying things that will resonate with the American public, mainly the economy and security, national security? Welcoming your phone calls in a moment. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Molly Ball is with us now, staff writer who covers U.S. politics at The Atlantic, and we're welcoming phone calls for her. 800-486-8655 is our number. Ray in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Ray.
Hi, I want to talk about the trade agreement, the Pacific Trade Pact, or whatever it's called, that Mr. Obama and a group of Republicans, ironically, have decided to make this a really important issue for them, seeing that NAFTA left a real bad taste in working people's mouths here in America. NAFTA was a big disaster for all of us. How the president could be walking this walk and talking this talk again, and his allies, our conservative Republicans, should make Republicans very nervous, and it should definitely make working America nervous. And then I want to just touch on this thing with the Confederate flag. My family is from the South, North Carolina, right on the North and South Carolina border, and I was always stunned that they were proud to fly that flag, and I understood what it meant as a kid growing up and how people of color would look at that and be outraged by it. But we as Americans should just think for 1 minute, what's the American Indian feel about the Stars and Stripes? Not only did we kill them, enslave them, but we also took their land.
Thank you very much, Ray, for your call. Let's start with trade. Molly?
It's a very interesting issue, and it is very ironic that in a week when Obama was being hailed by progressives for the Supreme Court victories and for the eulogy, there was very little directed his way on the trade victory that he also had last week, part of a sort of string of victories for him last week. And that's because most Democrats didn't like it. He was able to get it done only with help from Republicans. And it is a very similar situation to NAFTA, where Bill Clinton was up against most of the voices in the Democratic Party, and there was a lot of acrimony and bad blood, and he relied on Republicans to get it done. Now, the administration says this trade deal, which technically doesn't exist yet, but what they're working towards is a much more progressive trade agreement, and it's not NAFTA, it's much better. The labor community is very resolute against it and believes that it is just as bad as NAFTA. But in partisan terms, you have a split revealed in the Democratic Party. In a way, it's an old split between the sort of centrist Democrats that Bill Clinton represented and the liberal Democrats, who I think are an increasingly ascendant voice in the Democratic Party and who are powering this surge that we're seeing for Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary, where he's pulling within striking distance of Hillary Clinton in some places, and Elizabeth Warren, of course, who's a huge hero to a lot of progressives and who's been very outspoken against the trade deal. So that is something that is only going to continue. That is an internal sort of battle for the soul of the Democratic Party. That we're going to continue to see play out as we go toward 2016.
Thanks, Ray, very much for your call. John is next in Holton, Michigan. Hi, John.
Hi. I just was calling because a bit earlier you mentioned that all the Republicans seem to be against the ruling, but I want to mention that Rand Paul certainly wasn't, and really, his only comment was the opinion that I share, that government should be out of marriage and it should be left up to private individuals and groups. So be it.
Thanks, John, for your clarification. And it's good to know that. I was not aware of what Rand Paul had to say. You've written about Rand Paul recently. He's kind of... Well, go ahead.
Sorry. Yes. Well, thank you. It's hard to get to every candidate's stance when there are 16 of them.
Exactly. Yeah, I see your point.
This is going to be an ongoing issue as we cover the Republican primary. What I'm aware that Rand Paul has said in the past, and I don't have his statement on the ruling in front of me, is that he believes that this should be left to the states, and he personally is against same-sex marriage. So I do think the caller is right that he is more liberal or libertarian when it comes to this issue than a lot of the more socially conservative candidates. But he also has tried to reach out to social conservatives, particularly in Iowa, by saying that he does believe that this is something that states ought to be able to legislate and that he would take it out of the government's hands and therefore leave it up to churches and so on. So I do think he faces a little bit of the same problem in that he's still personally opposed to same-sex marriage, and that's not a point of view that a lot of young voters understand these days. But it is true that he has not gone nearly as far as the other candidates in terms of saying that the ruling was wrong and that he would resist it.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at those 16, there will be candidates, who knows, maybe even more. Are there a couple now? Is the field winnowing down to a couple? Is Jeb Bush, who started out kind of in a lackluster fashion, is he gaining momentum? Is it Scott Walker still going to win Iowa? Or are we going to have to hear from all 16 for a long time and thus not know what many of them are saying because there are too many of them?
Yeah, I think the answer to your first question, is the field winnowing, is no. The field continues to expand, actually. I think we have what we believe to be the last three entrants coming up in the month of July. We have Chris Christie announcing tomorrow, Scott Walker scheduled to announce in mid-July, and then after him, John Kasich. And I believe after that, we are finally done with all the announcements, and there will be 16 or 17 candidates. But I don't think we see any clarity, any separation in the Republican field. Scott Walker really jumped out front and distinguished himself with a great speech in Iowa that the activists really responded to many months ago. No other candidate has had a breakout moment like that. Jeb Bush, I thought, had a very good announcement event recently, but it didn't seem to catapult him forward in any meaningful way. He remains the front runner in some technical sense, in that he's barely a point or so in the lead in the average of national polls, which really doesn't mean anything. And so many candidates are still all bunched up at the back of the field. So I don't think we have any clarity. I do think it's going to be quite a while, or there's going to be some event, right, that will push some candidate toward the front and give them some separation, catch fire with the activist community. Maybe when fundraising reports come out, it'll be clear that someone's getting real traction in the donor community and other people are not, and they'll have to drop out. or the debates, you know, we'll see who gets into the debates and who has a good performance in the debates. Those are going to start relatively soon. The first one is in August in Cleveland. So there are some things we can point to on the calendar that may help us get our collective heads around this enormous field. But right now, I think Republican activists have got to be the most confused people in America because they have so many choices and there's not a lot of way to parse or distinguish all these candidates from one another.
And here's Rand Paul's statement about the gay marriage decision. Some have argued that the Supreme Court ruling will now involve the police power of the state in churches, church schools, church hospitals. This may well become the next step, and I will stand ready to resist any intrusion of government into the religious sphere. Since government has been involved in marriage, they have done what they always do, taxed it, regulated it, and now redefined it. It's hard to argue that government's involvement in marriage has made it better, a fact also not surprising to those who believe government does little right.
That's very interesting. Thank you for digging that up. And I do think it is consistent with what I said about what his stance has been in the past. And you see him also trying to appeal to the social conservatives by positioning himself against government interference in religion and therefore adopting that language of the religious freedom debate that says that now that the Supreme Court has imposed gay marriage on the country, we are going to have to guard against the mandatory enforcement against people of faith of these decisions that they may disagree with.
Mm-hmm. And thanks, KP, for looking that up for us quickly. Russell is next in Gutenberg, Iowa. Hi, Russell.
Hi. I just wanted to say I enjoy listening to your program, and in particular, this subject, you made a statement, or your speaker made a statement, that the decision, or these many of these decisions, particularly the recent one on gay marriage, would not be that angry old white people wouldn't like this. Well, I'm an old white person. I'm not angry about it. I'm not necessarily excited about it. But there's many old white people, conservatives in Iowa, who are not of the same thought process as many of the people that the politicians and the media is always quoting in Iowa. We have a lot of good open-minded and good-thinking people that still are old, but but I was offended when you say that old, angry old white people wouldn't like this, and I just thought that we need to be careful about how we label all these issues, too.
Yeah. Well, I'm an old white person, too, so I wasn't
no,
really
thank
offended.
You for calling. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to clarify that. I was, first of all, being deliberately hyperbolic and referring to a stereotype, right? I'm making fun of the stereotype that I think a lot of outsiders have of the Republican Party, and that Republicans who are not angry would like to push back against and get rid of, because it's not a flattering stereotype. I certainly am not myself saying that that constitutes the main constituency of the Republican Party. But, you know, if you are not angry, then you are not one of the people I'm talking about. There are angry old white people, and you're not one of them, clearly, because you're not angry.
But we're all angry at times, right? It's good to let your anger out at times.
Sure.
Russell, thank you very much for your call. Tom in Appleton. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Just a comment and then a rhetorical question for the guest. I agree that this is letting the Republican candidates off the hook on issues that have just simply become part of the zeitgeist of the nation, such as gay marriage acceptance, and that if anything, it's doing those candidates a favor. But in turning towards the economy, and this is the rhetorical question part, what, pray tell, is the Republicans' strength there? As far as I can tell, it consists of it's good to be rich. Is there more to it than that?
Well, that's the debate that I think we're going to have in the general election. A lot of Democrats believe that this is where they will continue to win the debate. This was the main playing field of the debate between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, painting Mitt Romney as, you know, being in favor of policies that favored the rich and an unfeeling corporate technocrat, and Obama as being for the middle class and for the little guy. And most Democrats believe that Hillary is just as well positioned in that debate, as not better, if not better. You have candidates like Jeb Bush saying, look how well Florida did when I was governor, promising 4% growth on the same kind of vague diet of tax cuts and trickle-down economics, but saying it worked then and it'll work again for the country. In most national polls, you do have people saying that they are pretty down on the way Obama has handled the economy. And they do trust Republicans more to handle that. And that was a major reason that Republicans did so well in the 2014 midterms, is that they were winning on the economic issues. So I don't know how that debate is going to go. I think both parties have strengths that they will be able to use.
Well, and what's interesting that the economy seems to play well for the Republicans, and it also plays well for very progressive Democrats, because it's one of the reasons that Bernie Sanders is doing so well, right?
Yeah, and this debate between the progressives and the sort of centrists in the Democratic Party is a very interesting one to me. I've been following it really closely. And I wrote about this when Hillary Clinton had her announcement speech. Everybody said, oh, it's such a populist speech. She's talking about inequality. If you actually listen to what she said, she really did not hit that note very much. She didn't talk about the gap between rich and poor in explicit terms. She didn't go after the wealthy. And this was very galling to the sort of Elizabeth Warren wing of the party, which listened closely to that speech and said, okay, sure, she's talking about helping people on the lower rungs of society, but she is not saying that the way to do that is to take down the rich. She's not going after the bankers. She's not going after Wall Street. And for the progressive wing of the party, they need to hear not only that you're going to address inequality, but that you're going to do it by going after the people at the top, the economic elites, the billionaires. And that is who Bernie Sanders is targeting in every speech that he gives. He's saying that the game is rigged. We have to change the rules of the economy that are allowing the big banks and Wall Street to profit at the expense of everyone else. You don't hear Hillary Clinton saying that. I think it's pretty unlikely that she will go that far, given the alliances she's built in the past and the fact that she was a senator from New York representing Wall Street in a lot of ways. So that's going to be a continuing source of angst, I think, for her on her left wing.
And this story is just beginning to achieve a lot of prominence. We haven't in America followed it as closely, perhaps, as we should have, because it's somewhere else and we love ourselves and tend to think of ourselves first. But this story about Greece and the banks in Greece closing, and talk today that maybe it could create financial problems, markets are down in Europe, that it could create a dissolution of the common currency, et cetera. Does this have ramifications for America? Is this going to be a really big story, Molly?
Obviously, it would be a huge story if Greece proceeds in the way that it could. I am not an expert on this, like many of your listeners that you referred to. I do know that this has been a political talking point for Republicans for quite some time, right? That Obama is leading the United States on a road to turning into Greece and to this kind of bankruptcy.
Yes.
And I don't think that's something that resonates with a lot of people. I think especially as the economy has gradually thawed and we've begun to dig out from the financial crisis and unemployment is down and people are feeling a little bit more secure, it has become less and less believable to people that we're actually on the verge of some kind of national meltdown as a result of spending and debt and government fiscal policies. So to the extent that it is going to actually materially affect us as a country, of course that's going to be a huge deal. But as a political talking point, I don't see it getting a lot of traction.
Thanks, Tom, for your call. Jake in Oshkosh. Hi. Hello, Jake.
Great guest. Hello, Kathleen. Great guest. I much respect Molly Ball's opinions, which is why I'm calling in.
Thank you.
I've been following these Supreme Court cases for quite some time and reading the rationale for some of these decisions. And my take on it is they're all over the wall. There's no rationale for some of the decisions they're making. And is it just me? Or, in Molly Ball's opinion, is it a real crapshoot? It just rolled the dice in terms of these decisions.
Molly?
It's an interesting question. I mean, the decisions today upholding lethal injection and striking down EPA rules were a good reminder, I think, to some of the liberals who were celebrating last week that this had been considered a quite conservative court for most of its lifespan, and that Anthony Kennedy was originally, you know, a conservative justice, and not all of these opinions are Kennedy's. He's the swing vote on the court. So if there is any consistency to be found in these decisions that are often, you know, 5-4 one way or the other, it's usually in the sort of quirky worldview of Justice Kennedy, which I think is not a particularly partisan worldview, and maybe libertarian more than anything, more than it is Republican or Democratic. And of course, we have to remember that to the extent that they're acting in good faith, the justices are not looking at the outcomes of their decisions in partisan terms. The justices are making what they believe are the right decisions according to the Constitution, and that may mean that a liberal law that you don't like is nonetheless found to be constitutional, or a conservative policy that you don't like is nonetheless something that is required under the interpretation of the Constitution. So, yes, it's hard to find consistency in terms of partisan outcomes, but I don't think that's the metric by which the court should be judged.
Jerry on Facebook asks, does Molly Ball think that the climate change denial position of most Republican candidates will have to be de-emphasized in the general campaign, just like marriage rights and the ACA?
That's a really interesting question. I wonder what role the environment is going to play in this campaign. The polling on this is pretty ambiguous. You do have a very large percentage of the American public that is still skeptical of climate change, despite the overwhelming scientific consensus, and I think we can say the facts of the issue. So Republican candidates have not, and you also don't have a very high priority being placed on these issues. So Republican candidates have not felt that they paid too much price for taking the conservative position or even the anti-scientific position on these debates. And you don't see a lot of signals from Hillary Clinton and the Democrats that they're going to make this a top priority or top sort of campaign wedge. But you never know. Things could change. You do have a lot of Republicans have used the actions of the EPA under Obama to make a larger argument that Obama is sort of lawless and out of control as an executive power, and the Supreme Court ruling today certainly gives ammunition to that argument.
Thank you so much, Jake, and for your call. And Jerry, thanks for your message. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation for all things political. Molly Ball is our guest, and she is a staff writer, covers U.S. politics at The Atlantic. We're talking about all the enormous events that have taken place in the last week. It is just amazing, a continuation of mourning and a call to remove the Confederate flag and for us to really examine our history of race in this country, going back to the days of slavery. President speaking at Reverend Clemente Pinckney's funeral. Joe Biden was there as well, and I guess he went back to the church yesterday. We are looking at the same-sex marriage, which we'll do for the full hour. We're looking at the Affordable Care Act, 6-3 ruling in that case. We're looking at lethal injection, which came down today, redistricting, and fair housing. We had a really interesting show on housing discrimination and why ghettos were created in this country last week. The fair housing decision was also an interesting one. So join us. What do you think of all these momentous events in the course of a week in this country? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Molly Ball is with us now, and it's all things political. You're listening to This Hour, 800-486-8655, the number. Gary in Madison, hello.
Yes, hi. I've got a question and then just a comment. I want to ask Molly if really down deep she feels that America would really elect a 75-year-old socialist from Vermont. I just can't see that happening. And, you know, when you look at Hillary, for heaven's sake, she was the first lady the Secretary of State. I'm not even sure Bernie Sanders has been to Europe. I'll take my comments off the air. Thanks very much.
All right, Gary, thanks for the call.
I'm pretty sure Bernie Sanders has been to Europe. You know, if you had asked someone, a political analyst 20 or 30 years ago, if we would ever have an African-American president who grew up in Hawaii, they would have said that that was inconceivable, someone, you know, with the middle name Hussein. So you never know what's going to happen in politics. I do think that at the moment, the Bernie Sanders vote is a protest vote from Democrats who don't like the idea that they're being asked to sort of ride along on a coronation, that, you know, not having had a say in their party's national standard bearer since 2008, they're now being told that they again don't really get a say in it. So and there is a hunger. I think there is a real phenomenon of this resurgence of liberalism. You see the number of Americans identifying as liberal rather than moderate or conservative is still a minority, but it's larger than it has been in the last, I think, 20 years, according to the Gallup tracking of this. And so there are a lot of people who feel that a much more aggressive and muscular sort of leftism is called for, given economic inequality in particular, and a lot of people don't feel that Hillary Clinton is the right messenger for that issue. So to answer your question, I think it is very difficult to imagine Bernie Sanders actually getting the nomination and actually being elected president, but stranger things can and do happen in American politics.
We go to Joan next in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I think in America, it's a big mistake to treat groups as monolithic, whether it's old or white. I'm 82, and I'm white. And you go back far enough, and there are plenty of divisions among black people, Native American people, Catholics. I happen to be Catholic, and it really ticks me off when headlines or even sub-headlines in the paper treat Catholics as monolithic. I'm a woman. Now, that might raise a few hackles. Maybe the majority of women are angry about something, and deeply angry.
Well, I think that we're not seeing things in a monolithic fashion. There are, though, if you look at statistics on things, there are certain ways that certain blocks of voters go, right? When you look at polling, et cetera, and certain white people in the South, if they're male, vote a certain way. If you're African American in the cities in this country, you vote another way, and they're opposed to each other. It's not saying it's monolithic forces. There are divisions, certainly, but there are trends, Molly. Isn't that fair?
Yes. No, I think you put that very well. And of course, we are never talking about 100% of people. We are talking about tendencies. We're talking about a majority of a certain group or a tendency among a certain group. It's interesting that the caller brought up Catholics, and Catholics are one of the sort of swingiest groups in American politics. The stereotypes about the Catholic vote really fall apart because in a lot of ways they're divided on all of the issues. They're not a particularly conservative voting bloc. I believe they actually tend to vote Democratic. And even on the issues where the Catholic Church has taken a stand, issues like gay marriage and abortion, Catholics don't tend to toe that line at all. And they've actually been one of the more supportive religious groups when it comes to gay marriage, for example. So, yes, whenever we are generalizing about a group, we're only ever talking about a tendency or a majority or even an image, right? In this case, we're talking about an image that outsiders may have, not a correct perception. I would urge people not to feel personally targeted by those kinds
right.
of descriptions.
I want to go back to the Affordable Care Act for a moment because it was a major decision, and perhaps there were so many of them we forgot Thursday because we had Friday, and it's an interesting decision from the Supreme Court. 6-3 makes it even remarkably more so. I want to ask Molly how they decided this. Was it the fact that millions of people would lose health insurance that may have been first and foremost, and whether or not this has been debated for so long with so many attempts at repeal, and it's hard to believe that this won't still be a focal point of campaign conversation among Republican candidates. Here's what the president had to say about the ruling. If you've seen the picture of him, he was very delighted the way the Supreme Court ruled. Here's what he said, and we'll ask Molly more about why they did say what they said last Thursday.
And today, after more than 50 votes in Congress to repeal or weaken this law, after a presidential election based in part on preserving or repealing this law, after multiple challenges to this law before the Supreme Court, the Affordable Care Act is here to stay. This morning, the court upheld a critical part of this law, the part that's made it easier for Americans to afford health insurance regardless of where you live. If the partisan challenge to this law had succeeded, millions of Americans would have had thousands of dollars worth of tax credits taken from them. For many, insurance would have become unaffordable again. Many would have become uninsured again. Ultimately, everyone's premiums could have gone up. America would have gone backwards. And that's not what we do. That's not what America does. We move forward.
Can you talk a bit? So many people have talked about how historic this law has been. He will be defined by the Affordable Care Act as the legacy of his presidency, although we may add to that list after the last couple of weeks as well, and that this is another indication that this law is here to stay. Could you comment on each of those and more if you'd like, Molly?
Sure. I mean, this has always been the sort of central legacy item for the Obama presidency. This has always been the biggest sort of long-term change to American public policy that he has made. And conservatives have always been confident that the law would fall apart. They've also been confident that it was unconstitutional, and we've now seen twice that the Supreme Court has disagreed with that analysis. In 2012, there was a constitutional challenge to the law that failed, and again now in 2015, a constitutional challenge to the law has failed. So, you know, the court has said that like this law or not, and it's not the court's job to decide whether it's a good law or not, but like it or not, it is constitutional. And that means that if you have a problem with it, you've got to go through the political process to solve that. Another thing I think we've seen is that the predictions that this would cause an economic disaster have largely not come true. Now, you have Republicans pointing to things here and there that they say are bad effects from Obamacare, but it certainly is not true that we've taken a giant step backwards in terms of economic progress. In fact, the economy seems to continue to be improving, and the law appears to be accomplishing what it set out to do in terms of getting health insurance to a lot of people who didn't have it before in a way that they can afford. And so you do see that the opposition to the law has had to grapple with those facts and to find different arguments against the law and to look for different avenues to change it.
Let's go to Stan in Madison next. Hello, Stan.
Oh, thanks for letting me ask a question. I was surprised to hear about the redistricting decision, because I just didn't know it was before the Supreme Court, and I'm very pleased to see that this challenge to independent commissions has been put down. The question I have is, here in Wisconsin, we've had great deal of discussion in our major newspapers about the need to go to an independent commission. Can your guest please fill us in a little bit about the background to this decision? How did this come about in the first place, and how can we move forward and really finally make all the states have independent commissions?
Thanks, Stan. We have about a minute, Molly.
I'll try to be quick. This was a challenge to an independent redistricting commission in Arizona, and the challenger said that, you know, the Constitution says legislatures have to draw the districts, and this court said no, if the legislature hands that power off to a commission, that's okay too. And in partisan terms, a lot of Democrats have pushed these because they are at a hopeless disadvantage in the nation's state houses, and that has led to Republicans being able to draw very advantageous congressional and legislative district maps. And so Democrats have tried to fight this by creating these independent commissions, which hypothetically would do this in a more fair-minded way. But this issue of drawing legislative districts is so complicated that it's almost impossible to do so in a way that is completely neutral, because it's just not clear what that standard would be. So this is going to continue to be a tug of war between the parties because their jobs are at stake.
Mm. Molly, thank you very much for being with us. It was a week to remember, that's for sure.
It sure was.
Yes,
thanks for having me.
Thanks, Molly. Molly Ball, staff writer who covers U.S. politics at The Atlantic, our guest for All Things Political. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour and for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about the Supreme Court decision, the historic victory to the gay rights movement, because we're going to spend the next full hour on that. We'll have two guests with us to look at why the court ruled the way it did and the response to the ruling, and a little bit of the history of how this, the years and the decades before this ruling, the Freedom to Marry movement. So stay with us for that. And thank you for listening and for your calls for All Things Political, which, by the way, you always hear on Mondays at 1 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.